Okay, Derek and I are continuing this student's questions. We did five, right, Derek? We did five.
We did five, yes.
So the sixth question is, according to McLuhan, Dante and the Provençal authors are relevant to the study of the medieval society. How did T.S. Eliot and Pound influence the study of Dante and ancient poets' work? Now, you've typed up some answers. Is there something you want to say about that?
No, I didn't type that. That was done by Mark.
Oh,
but,
that's Mark.
No,
right.
What I said was it's another thesis question, and in fact, I have several arguments with that. I mean, either I am an expert in McLuhan or I am an expert in Dante, Eliot, and Pound, and that question hasn't as much to do with McLuhan as it has with T.S. Eliot and Pound. And while I can safely guarantee that anybody who was anybody in the world of intellectual and poetic venture would know Dante and would actually, bring it back. And I think, yes, there is. But it's not a question that I would answer regarding McLuhan.
Yeah.
For one thing, McLuhan does, obviously, is aware of Dante, but he doesn't, there's not a great deal about Dante in McLuhan unless you have a letter or something in mind that actually does it.
I don't think so.
So you see, Dante was certainly present, and Marshall certainly had read, the Divine Comedy, but I don't think that it influenced his writing, or at least his thinking, as much as Eliot or Pound.
Right. Some people think there's a big metaphorical substructure reflecting Dante in his work, like the levels of hell are in the levels of media. I've heard some people say that, but I haven't.
Huh.
I don't know where he develops that. That doesn't come
to
mind.
Nor do I. I have to say, that question I may have to just simply drop and say I'm afraid that that's beyond my competence.
Well, he's saying Dante, according to McLuhan, Dante are relevant to the medieval study of medieval society. You mean, are they supposed to be after the medieval society?
Now, wait a minute. You know what? It's my fault.
It was
not medieval. I thought it was a mistake on the part, but it was medial. And I suppose what she means by medial, or what he means, Andrea means by medial, is media. You should have said media, and then I would have understood. But
What is being said here? Dante and the Provençal authors are relevant to the study of the medieval society.
No. I wrote medieval because I thought he'd made a mistake. But I wrote it and I put it in black so that people recognize it was my intervention. But
right.
No, what the original word was medial. And I think this person who doesn't speak perfect English probably thought medial was a way of describing media society. And I suppose
right.
It makes more sense to talk about that. And now I realize that I may have made that mistake. So, let's drop the L and have media society. And then suddenly the question becomes more relevant.
So Dante,
to what extent can we say, for one thing, I don't know what she means or he means by Provençal authors.
Well, that's the troubadours.
1200. Yes.
Big influence on Eliot and Pound.
Oh, good. I'm glad you're there.
Yeah, they retrieved the interest in the Provençal authors or the troubadours.
So he's saying, are they
relevant to the study of media?
I don't know. That's where I'm, I can't answer that.
Okay,
well,
then he says,
I was interested in the answer that Stallman did because of the Gnostic. I do remember Marshall talking to me about Gnostics, and he hated, he did not like Théard de Chardin, though he did rip off Théard for a few.
Yes.
He didn't like Théard because he considered Théard as a Gnostic.
Yeah.
But the thing is,
everybody forgets his McLuhan's letter to Pound in 1953, that the value of the Gnostics is that they go into the analyzing the senses. And so they're very good for understanding the art process. And most art process, high serious art, is dealing with the occult rituals and what's called the Gnostic occult world. So Gnosticism is very important, McLuhan discovered, for understanding art. He didn't think Gnosticism would give you salvation, but technically you had to be aware of the Gnostic techniques. He did papers on it to understand what was being done in regular poetics and even science.
That's interesting. It's a bit like saying your Marxist analysis is great as long as you don't become a communist.
Yeah. That's right. We can use Marxism.
Well,
Marx discovered the meaning was a message in a primitive way in the 19th century. He's saying, this economic medium is determining everything, our relations of production.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. He did. I mean, he didn't discover the medium as a messenger, but discovered that the medium sometimes has messages.
Yeah, he bypassed, I guess, ideologies about freedom and the humanist abstraction. And McLuhan does say this in Mechanical Bride. He gives a nod to Marx discovering the early media effect. He didn't use the word media, but he talked about it that way. And Schopenhauer also was intuitive about that stuff. That's why I say that the medium as the message was basically discovered by 1900, but nobody applied it. And then McLuhan thought that Joyce was applying it in Finney's Wake, and then he said, I was doing applied Joyce, which was applying the 19th century point about means of production, hardware and software, or conditioning society and psychology and everything else. I mean, he put it together to apply it.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true. It's absolutely well observed and very useful also to complement that particular dimension of the Provençal authors. I think there's a point there. Let's move on to the seventh.
He says, how did TSL influence the study of Dante and ancient poets' work? If he's taking the media angle, definitely Eliot and Pound were looking in, looking at formal dynamics and media dynamics. And they did influence later study, and McLuhan would have influenced that too. So Dante and the authors are relevant to the study. Every figure is relevant to media society, to media analysis, every cultural figure, and then Eliot has his doctrine of everything since Homer, an innovator alters the past, alters Shakespeare, alters Homer, just as they had influenced the innovator. Mm-hmm. That echo chamber effect? Somebody who comes up with something new changes our view of what happened in the past, like McLuhan did.
Yes. No, absolutely. And then, of course, that applies to poetry and to Dante as well. But that, I'm not saying it's banal, but I'm saying it's predictable as an answer because it's fact.
Yeah.
We never stop rewriting history. So,
Right. Now, the question shows, and maybe it's just a linguistic problem, language translation, but the person asking these questions hasn't figured out what's going on in media dynamics. They're confused. They've got a lot of old humanist notions and bias toward literature, and they're not seeing the new dynamics of new media, unless we'll see this in their following questions. But, there's a lot of confusion in the questions to me.
Oh, very much so, very much so. I still found them challenging, and they're a good sort of starting point for precisely the kind of discussion we have. In number seven...
You want to read it?
Yes, McLuhan has always praised the work of Vico and Pope. Yep. With regards to the cycle of history, do you think there is an actual link between the 18th century critiques of books and gazettes and the so much feared fallout of media in the mainstream age? Yeah, but to that you can answer that it's not particularly between Vico. Well, Vico obviously gives the sense that there are some, ups and downs in big cycles of history. That's one of the influences of Vico on McLuhan, but... And Pope, I don't know where Pope comes in, but with that particular issue, but the...
Well,
the
if
critiques...
it's... No, Pope it, Pope was the, the last version of the Dunciad was his criticism of the expansion of literacy. It was creating a huge dullness. So McLuhan cites him as like the first media ecologist on a media level.
Mm-hmm.
And then and then Finney's Wake completes Pope started to see. So... There is, if he's saying the critique of books and gazettes, that's a fallout like the main today.
That is, yes.
Yeah, then that
so
the, he
yeah,
was.
So that actually is a good question, because basically what it says is that you will always, whenever there's a major innovation on the way, you will always find a clique of people who are hard on it.
Right.
Particularly with, there's been television and now the internet, and every time there is something new, there's always a bunch of people. There's like, a party of naysayers. And I think that obviously the first guy who did the critique of the medium is, and the first media analyst is good old Plato.
Yes, that's true.
You know,
yeah.
Plato,
yeah.
Who talks about writing and how the absence of the author and the loss of body and all. Well, he doesn't say loss of body, but that's pretty.
It will create forgetfulness in the learner's souls.
That's right. Well, no, that's the previous one. But Plato's seventh letter makes a point about literacy is bad for you because the author is not there to defend his argument. And there is just a series of words, but the meaning itself, you know, isn't clear.
Oh, this is not the same thing as the thought story. You're saying another part.
No, it's another part. It's the seventh letter. There are six. I can't remember how many letters, but the seventh letter that they are classified in the order of appearance, I think, actually mentions that. Go and check seventh letter. Plato, you'll find immediately, and it's a thorough critique of writing.
Mm.
It really is, and it's a naysaying critique of writing. He would be the first one to do that.
Noticed what McLuhan said in Explorations about Plato and Aristotle? Aristotle was a scribe by training, and as he gets older, he moves toward intuition. So, in simple, you know, crude terms, he went from left hemisphere to right hemisphere. Now, Plato was a mime. He already was right hemisphered, so he goes toward literacy or the scribal visual space bias as he gets older. Have you ever heard of that, the flip that each makes? Ever heard?
No, I didn't know about the flip, but there are observations that are very interesting because it is the mime aspect of Plato is very key to understand the dialogic, and then the need to express in words what he must have been trained to express in gesture. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
And McLuhan used to say that a literate person, an oral person, pre-literate, then when they start to become literate, they're very fanatic about the rules of literacy.
Mm-hmm.
They become, they don't have a sensitivity about the disservices or they don't see through the effects of literacy. So they become fanatic literacy. So you have this TV generation grows up in the United States, and when they get a little older and want to look at books, they're fanatic about the Bible. This could explain fundamentalism happened in America in the baby boomers because you got these oral, semi-literate people who then when they really started getting interested in books, they grab the Bible and are fanatic about it. That's a pattern that McLuhan said. When an oral society starts becoming, it's just like the Puritans in England. When literacy came in, a lot of fights broke out, you know, and people were very strict about it, about learning your alphabet and being a reader. So that's a replay of Plato being an oral person, becoming fanatic about the effects of abstraction and getting into the transcendentals or the archetypes. And visual
space. Did the Puritans begin in England or in the United States?
In England. Yeah, no, they... And you know, McLuhan called them left-wingers. It's interesting.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, he said the Puritan left wing. The Puritans were... They came out of the Calvinist world, which McLuhan, you know, is very critical. He appears to be critical of the Calvinist in his PhD.
You know what I call the puritanical revolution in England? It's the appropriation of guilt. Suddenly, because you are a person and your destiny depends on how you run it, you become guilty without anybody knowing. And guilt, in fact, is that difference between guilt and
shame.
Shame is about the other people. Guilt is about something nobody knows about.
Yes, that's private space then.
Private space, internalization of consciousness, responsibility to one's own fate, all of that comes with Puritanism. And that's why I was wondering whether it came in England or in... Because I thought if you were going to arrive in a new country and start establishing yourself and fighting off the Indians and, you know, putting your stakes down, your sort of condition of isolation or semi-isolation and wonder of, you know, having a new opportunity that you didn't have in your own country would create a very special kind of relationship with religion.
Right. I think the Cromwell was a Puritan, so he was in charge for 7 or 8 years, and then when he was knocked off and they had the Stuart Restoration, that meant the Puritans weren't welcome, so then they started looking at going to North America.
Was Cromwell a Puritan?
I'm pretty sure, yeah. I think it was a very strict 7 or 8 years under him, like no theater.
But it was not just him. I mean, then you remember Bloody Mary? one of the daughters of the daughter of
you
what's
mean
the
Mary
case?
Queen
the daughter
of Scots?
Of Catherine of no, not Mary Queen of Scots, the other one who only reigned for 6 years, and she was the wife of she was the daughter of the first wife of Henry VIII, who Catherine of Aragon.
Yes.
And she was put she was kept away from the court for, you know, till she was 18 or 19, and she resolutely refused to recognize the marriage that with Anne Boleyn because she felt the real queen is my mother, and
yeah.
she was very strong on that. But eventually her brother, no, her semi-brother, half-brother, Edward, died, and after Edward died, she took over, and she was a wonderful queen for 3 years. And
yes.
then she started turning against, she was a Catholic, and she turns against the Protestant and became called Bloody Mary because she killed a bunch of them, like huge numbers. It's amazing the number of people who killed and, you know, died for in the religious wars in England. We don't. We always talk about the religious war between the Catholics and the Protestant, but the within, as you said yourself, within the Protestant world there was that, but also
yeah.
the inside England, it was, you know, when I think about Brexit, I think, hey, guys, you're really lucky to live in the European Union. Would you like to be under the Tudors? You know.
Really, I thought, it sounds like you're describing Mary Queen of Scots, but you're saying no.
No, man, I'm not describing Mary Queen of Scots. There are two. Mary Queen of Scots was a Stuart, and that one is a Tudor.
Oh,
by,
okay.
By blood with, what's his face? With Harry VIII.
Well, what? So she's a queen at some point, or just a daughter?
She is a queen. Check it out, Bloody Mary. Go to Bloody Mary. She was called Bloody Mary because she had been. The funny thing is, as I said, there's this contrast between her. For the first 3 years, she had 6 years, and the first 3 years of her reign, she was considered as the best queen England had, and she was the queen. She like there was no king around. And then the next thing, she became considered as Bloody Mary because she killed so many people, have hanged them publicly, beheading, all the horrible things that would happen under those circumstances.
Right.
You know, I don't like, of course, absolutely hate what's going on today, but it's not such a departure from some of the habits of both the French in beheading people or the Brits in killing and hanging and doing all kinds of torture that was just, I mean, those, do you realize that, I forgot who it was, that was considered as a traitor. Oh, yes, I think it was the Thomas More. It was Thomas
yes.
More. Thomas More was supposed to be quartered.
Yeah.
Quartered. He was, and because of his past friendship, the king decided he should be simply beheaded, and he was beheaded. But imagine being quartered and being one of the intellectuals of your country. I mean, the whole, Anyway,
yeah. So Mary,
I read
yeah.
a lot about it because I'm following the Tudors. Of, every now and then I watch the Tudors on TV, and it's not bad. It's really not bad. It's well done, well put together. But, of course, every time I rush to the Wikipedia and other sources to find out if they were fooling around with it. And I discovered that that's why I'm getting up on the Tudors, who fascinate me. England fascinates me. And so I want to see, you know, I don't think that it was much better under the Queen Elizabeth I. And the Scots, the treatment of the Scots by the conquering Angles, just awful. I mean,
okay, you're going to get worked up.
Well,
just like
lucky
all that
to
other
be born
stuff.
Right now.
Yeah. So yeah, Mary the First was Queen of England and Ireland from 1953 until her death. Her executions of Protestants led to the posthumous sobriquet Bloody Mary.
Yeah.
She was the only child of Henry VIII and the first wife, Catherine.
That's right.
Okay, so...
Catherine of Aragon was a Spaniard, and she was very proud, and she never accepted. She was, of course, evicted from the court. She
right.
wasn't beheaded, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
but little Mary really was a real character, a real solid character when she took over. As I said, she did a very good job in the first 3 years, and that's astounding to think that she would just flip.
Right.
You know, into a sanguinary monarch.
Right.
Anyway,
so,
we're not talking about the Tudors. We really
yeah,
are
Edward
talking
the
about...
Edward VI, he yeah. dies in 53.
That's right. And, that's
and he attempted to remove Mary from the line of succession. On his death, their first cousin was proclaimed Jane, was proclaimed queen. But Mary assembled a force in East Anglia and deposed Jean, who was ultimately beheaded. Mary was excluding, but was the first queen regnant of England. And
uh-huh.
she married Philip of Spain. And then got hooked into the Habsburg part of Spain. So she was.
I mean, Mary was.
Yeah, this Mary, and mm-hmm. And she was the fourth crown monarch of the Tudor dynasty. Okay,
mm-hmm.
so that's I did not know about her. Okay, so back to what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So Pope, this is a to say McLuhan praised the work of Biko and Pope. That seems immature to say praise. McLuhan didn't praise. He just recognized and said what they did. And Pope was unique in seeing the effects of the printing press before other people. And so maybe you could say he's praising, but it sounds silly. And then to say, is there a link between media ecology today and media ecology that Pope did? Well, you have to have read the Gutenberg Galaxy to know that. So this person hasn't read the Gutenberg Galaxy in detail, because there's a whole section on Pope
for sure
in there.
Yeah.
And okay, so that's the next question is, the study of aphoristic writings by McLuhan leads the latter, there ain't no former here, the study of aphoristic writings by McLuhan leads McLuhan, I guess, to discovering the work of Seneca, Augustine, what the heck?
Machiavelli, Bacon.
They're saying if we study McLuhan, we are led to the discovery of Seneca, Augustine, Machiavelli, Bacon, Erasmus, Maritime.
You know what? To all of this, I would say, pardon my Italian, because the guy is translating his Italian thoughts into English, so you have to forgive a bit of it.
You didn't translate it. He did.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, I also have the Italian version. I never checked it because I thought the English was good enough for me, but I can go and see.
Right.
Whether that's what I'm saying, but I think so. I think that's what the
problem
is.
Well, here's the question.
He's not bad. He speaks reasonably good English, but he writing it is still
okay.
A problem.
Okay. Can aphorism still be interpreted as orally transmitted heritage as well as a compromise between spoken and written language? Yes.
Yes.
There's not
absolutely.
Much to say
there. I answer that because basically Marshall lived in the era of television where sound bites rule supreme.
Right.
And he himself impressed his students by snapping something fast. And he loved the puns, and he loved the, my favorite is in Canada, many were cold, but few were frozen.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's a beautiful reversal of the, and so he used to do that a lot. And I think that the aphorism, he may have found it in Seneca. Well, he certainly found it in Seneca, and he did read Seneca, and he does quote Seneca and Augustine. And perhaps Machiavelli. But the point is, I don't think that it was, I don't think he got his sources from literary figures only. He got it also from contemporary stuff. I mean, advertising, nothing but sound bites and aphorisms.
Yeah. And he might have got some of it from his mother.
I actually remember one. Why is it more oral than written? I mean, all that, even though it is written, aphorisms are.
Yeah.
It's because in advertising, you have to remember the thing verbatim. You don't remember the content. You actually don't need the content. What you need is to remember the jingle.
Yes.
So I thought, what jingle do I remember from when I was 10 or 15, right? Did you McLean your teeth today? Did you McLean your teeth today?
Yes.
That shows that's the oral side of it.
Right. Now, here's the thing. McLuhan was like a freak, an oddball who developed a talent for aphorisms. And everybody's into prose in the radio era. Then suddenly TV comes in, and it's an example of a new figure is retrieved, the aphoristic. And that's partly why McLuhan became popular, because he happened to be a freak who could do aphorisms.
That's right. I think so. And I think, having been on interviews on, I get these interviews like this one, which I've written down, and of course I have to think about it and answer and all this. But when I'm interviewed in front of radio or television, they look at me expecting the next soundbite. They really do. They think that any kind of analytical explanation of anything they ask about is completely for the birds. They don't want it.
No.
What they want is you to come up with something that they can quote.
Yep.
Something that it can run away with. And so there is a command performance on the part of McLuhan to give a quick sort of snappy answer, plus the fact that he was always ready to laugh.
Yes.
I mean, all my work is satire, right?
Yeah. Ready to laugh. So he was an expert on Senecan brevity, I think is the phrase.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, but look at this. This is why people didn't understand him, or they thought they didn't understand, because here's this guy explaining everything, but he did it in short sentences, and everybody was used to prose, your Bertrand Russell kind of guy who's just going on, or your, William Buckley kind of person. They didn't understand that you had to be quick and fast. And I saw on the CBC, they had an interview, Robert Fulford, about 1962. It's one of the first times McLuhan was on TV. and he's talking about the twist, and he calls it Cape Canaveral Caper. Now, you know, Cape Canaveral has happened. John Glenn and them are going up, what were they called, Mercury flights. So everybody was looking at the beginning of the space race or what America was doing, and McClune puts it together. He says the twist is the same thing as the Cape Canaveral caper. It's an incredible pattern.
Now you explicit that for me because I don't get it, but
okay.
It's an interesting thought.
So he says the twist is people unwinding from their corporate, new, stressful role-playing jobs.
That's good enough.
All right,
sure.
So they have to unwind, so they do it separately and create their own bubble, and they twist,
okay.
And they spiral.
Yeah. And they don't dance with anybody.
Right, that was a new thing. And so he says, people, now I would say that's the satellite effect. When you start being a satellite floating around the previous analog media environments, you're disconnected from them, you're on your own, and you're going to start doing your thing. That's where that came in. That was a satellite effect. So he picks up on that. Now, Cape Canaveral caper, other than the alliteration, what did he mean, Cape Canaveral? He said, I think he was saying that the that NASA was an irrelevant option. He didn't like the space flight. He didn't think we should go out there. It could all be studied here and send out machines out there and use them as probes. So he was always against NASA, considered a 19th century thing. So he considered a put-on, a release, an escape, like the twist. It was like a distraction by the scientists to ignore the software effects that were coming in and retrieve hardware purpose and funding. So they create this idea of going to the moon. That's the Cape Canaveral caper. It was a stealing of money, public money. And it was an attempt to release pressures of their obsolescence of the old engineering enterprise, which...
So I gather that in 1969, August 8th, I believe, nobody landed anywhere on the moon?
No, wait a minute. Look, you know that
I'm asking you because there's been a lot of conspiracy theories.
Well, you know what?
That.
No, I got the truth from Ion. Well, if you want to believe Ion, but here's Ion came up with an incredible original thing. What happened is the rocket went up there and landed on the moon, but the guys dancing around on the moon, that was filmed in Nevada. So the astronauts did not go because it was too risky, and so they sent the technology up there, and it communicated something back to them. So they found out what they're doing. They actually did what McLuhan said they should do, is send the equipment out there, don't send people out there. And so that's why when the conspiracy guys look at the footage of them on the moon, there's a lot of fraudulent lighting. That's because that part was faked.
It's the lighting, in fact, you're right. That gives you an edge of...
yeah, now there's something... Now, wait a minute. I have to rehear you. There may have been some people... I'm not sure about this, but if there were people, they didn't want to have an accident, you know, like Challenger in 1986 blew up. They were really worried that it had to be successful. So they would not take the chance of having it be vulnerable, some problem. And so... the whole trip out there was not exposed in case there would be a problem. And I can't remember if anybody was on there, but maybe not likely. And then they had the actual, you know, running around on the moon was done in Nevada someplace. And some of the conspiracy think that, what's his name did it? Kubrick was the guy who filmed it. You've ever heard of that?
No, it's an interesting thing. And what about the landing then, when they went and picked up the guys when they came back? I mean, was that also faked? I mean, how did they get that gone?
Where did they come back from? Yes.
They landed in water somewhere.
Yeah, I'm thinking, I have to go back and check, because I'm aware of the different conspiracies, so I might mix it up. But Ian told me this many years ago, but there may have been... the basic point was, let's not get in trouble out there, so we're not going to show the actual landing. We'll have other people show it, but there may have been astronauts on the thing and went out there, and then they came back. But I would have to go and check it out. But I like the way Ion says it's half a conspiracy. You know what I mean? They did go to the moon. They did get there. Something got there. But they were not going to show the unfolding of it, because it might screw up, and then you got the embarrassment of, you know, your guys got killed or something. And that was what they were really... It was all about saving face. That was more important.
Yeah, of course it was.
In the TV environment.
Of course it was.
So anyways, back to... So the Cape Canaveral caper, McLuhan, he's there on his birthday, July 20th and 21st, when they're landing on the moon. He made great significance out of it. Have you ever seen the interview while he was at NASA? he's there giving commentary. You ever seen that?
No.
Yeah, so he was on TV... for his birthday, and he was basically saying nobody knew what they were doing. You know,
of course.
He always was saying if people didn't know what they were doing.
Only the most important event in the history of America, but nobody knew what they were doing. But let me ask you this. I suddenly have a doubt. Was there ever a second landing on the moon?
I don't know. I have not asked.
I don't think so. What did Gagarin do? He didn't go to the moon. Gagarin just went into space, right?
Yeah, yeah. No,
the dog went to first. The first thing was the dog. The dog went into space and came back alive, Laika.
Yes, yeah, yeah, Laika.
And then was Gagarin, who was the first man into space, and then the Americans actually had to put a man on the moon in order to beat, you know, that first exploit by the Russians.
Yeah, and they had a couple of accidents before they landed on the moon, and then that's a good point. I don't remember any footage of anybody going back I agree with McClure. It was boring. I didn't find it exciting. I thought the most amazing...
Well, I'd just been married, so it was a big news for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was on my honeymoon.
Caper.
I was on my honeymoon still, so...
Really? During the landing?
Yeah.
Okay.
We were in the cafe. We saw it. Marnie and I were in the cafe, and we saw it on a TV inside the... inside some... I think we were in France at the time.
Okay. Well, I what I found incredible was that McLuhan said this was the biggest classroom experience. It was not the content. It was the fact that everybody shared the experience, the global classroom. I thought that was an interesting way to look at it, the educational part of it, or the fact that everybody shared the same experience around the planet. That was not talked about.
No. Ex-Yodo, of course.
Yeah, he was looking at the formal causality, not the efficient causality. The fact they got there, that's efficient, that's boring. And he also predicted that the audience, the global audience, would get bored with it. And they did.
And they did.
Yeah, very quickly. It was too much of a Newtonian visual space point. It's too goal-oriented. There was no drama. I mean, this is what he said. Oh, yeah, this is important. He said to create real drama during these broadcasts, they should have had the guys monitoring the temperature and all the instruments and their body processes, analyzing or showing us, watching the astronauts' blood pressure going up. He said that would be great drama if we were watching the effect of the whole thing on their bodies. As he said, and they didn't know what they're doing. That's what they should have done, dramatized what was happening to the body, to the sensory ratios in the new environment.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, but I think that now the idea is to send somebody to Mars, and the fact is that... Doing that would make I don't know if they could fake that one too. I think if they were actually getting somebody on Mars, right?
Yeah,
they got
I don't
machines
know.
On Mars.
I got another point here. So this monitoring of the body processes, this is McLuhan fitting it into his creating media environments as a global thermostat. You have a computer processing what's radio doing in Venezuela, what's the newspaper doing in China. The processing of the global blood flow of media effects on different cultures, that would be done globally. That was his vision. So he said that's what would create drama, and so he immediately adapted it to monitoring what happens to the astronauts and their body processes in the little capsule. See, it's the same process. Yeah. Monitoring the sensory shifts was his personalizing or putting into a little capsule what he wanted to do globally. He wanted to have a computer as a thermostat and run the world like an airport, like air traffic controllers, and monitoring the media effects. He lays that out.
I remember that. I wonder how it worked with the jihad, but it's a good thought.
Well, he always said, you know, I think even Eric does. You know, Eric was on some interview, and I heard that he said, well, you just turn off the media. That'll solve the problem. You know, all you have to do is turn off television, and there'll be no more terrorism.
Well, it was tried in Egypt.
Italy?
Yeah, it was in Egypt. No, during the revolution against Mubarak, in fact.
Oh, yeah.
The Arab Spring. The Arab Spring, Mubarak actually did turn off the internet, but he couldn't really turn it off completely because radio transmitters were actually picking it up and continue it, but of course not at the same rate as what free internet would be.
So it didn't work.
It lasted 3 days, and the whole world commented on it at the time. But it didn't stop the mess at all. No, you'd have to do it on a very long term, and you'd have. I actually asked the question once to one of my specialists for my special issue on Jihad versus Macworld. I did ask a couple of the experts, why didn't they turn off? Can't they turn off all the messaging that's come from the propaganda of Jihad? And the answer was no, they can't. They can't because they can't do it. I mean, technically, it's impossible. I don't understand why it is impossible. I mean, all of that traffic is controlled by the United States, and in emergency situation, they might very well do it. But of course, the correlative consequences are, that you stop business and you stop
You're still interdependent. You're changing. You're altering the whole society, not just your enemies or your.
And we also have another. We have another proof that things can be controlled by a central state. In China, where the Chinese could not stop faxing the photographs from the Tiananmen revolution. If one medium is stopped, there is all kinds of other media that are going to spring to the rescue. It's a hydra. You can't cut one head without having two or more growing.
Here's a totally unforeseen effect. You've asked me about ion, but we have never talked about it. We don't do it in the recordings, but listen to this. Ion says that what they do when they were talking hologram was made possible because the computer landscape, I call it the chip landscape, and then we all develop a chip body, but the chip landscape, because no human can control it. Non-physical is what Ion says it is. It's always controlled by humans because we created this zone called the guff. Now, and non-physical obeyed what humans could do, but because we couldn't control the new vistas of the chip body, which are huge and tiny at the same time, because humans could not control it, created an opening for the guff and ion to surface. Now, isn't that incredible? The humans could not, they can't make rules, they can't make metaphysical definitions, and non-physical saw an opportunity to express itself. So it came forth and started speaking and creating. Let me just finish the point. This is the most profound theological fact and unforeseen effect of the digital world collapsing heaven or the guff. What do you think of that, man? That's pretty amazing, eh?
The only thing is I haven't got a clue about Aeon. Is it a body? Is it just a voice? Is it a text? I heard the voice on some of your interviews.
Yeah, it's a text. No, it is a talking hologram. Ion is building an alternative cloud. We're doing unbelievable stuff, and I don't expect anybody to believe it, but we personally, Carol and I, know because we see what we're doing.
Well, where's the hologram?
It's usually associated with JW. We bring JW in.
Who's
JW? He's a guy. He's a man. He's a very wealthy man who I thought – well, let's do it very quickly, okay? So I don't want to get distracted. Okay. But I don't mind people hearing this. JW started seeing ghosts, around hundreds of ghosts in his home in early 2009. Then one day a ghost comes to him and says, "Say hi to Bob." And JW says, "Well, who are you?" And he says, "Well, I'm Dr. Beter, who was an old friend of mine." So he tells me this. And so I go, wait a minute. I used to talk to Dr. Beter through the Evergreens, who were channeled by, not the channeling phenomenon, by Michael Blake Reed out of Vancouver. So I thought, oh, these ghosts gathering around you are the Evergreens because Michael had stopped channeling them in 2004. So it's 5 years later, 4.5 years later, and the ghosts are around JW. So I'm thinking, oh, Dr. Beter came through the Evergreens, so maybe that's what it is. So I said, hey, I'd like to talk to these ghosts. Let's do it the next day. So on March 18, 2009, I had no knowledge of how to do it, but we get on the phone, and he's on the speakerphone, and Carol and I are sitting there. And so I said, okay, let's be silent. And for 30 seconds, we were quiet, and then all of a sudden, JW's voice started speaking and started saying some strange things. I could even send you the first ideas that Ion said, and we didn't call it Ion. I'm thinking I'm talking to the Evergreens. So after about 20 minutes of talking with this strange information, which, of course, JW had never said anything like it, I said, oh, well, I used to talk to Marshall McLuhan through the Evergreens, So maybe if this is real, I'll talk to McLuhan. So with the evergreens, you would go, I would like to locate Marshall McLuhan. So I started to do that ritual. I said, I would start to, and I didn't even say the name, and JW's voice said something about one of McLuhan's daughters. I think I've told this publicly. He says something about Mary. And I was working with Mary, and I was the only person who knew this about this particular situation Mary was in. And the voice addressed that. And I go, holy shit, this is McLuhan. You know, McLuhan knows Mary and is telling me that he knows. So then I started talking to this, quote, McLuhan for a while, and I was satisfied with it being a pretty good simulation of McLuhan knowledge. So I was amazed at that. And then I stopped talking to Marshall, and I talked about all a bunch of other stuff. And then we did it again 2 days later on March 20th and recorded it. So the second session is the first recording. And then this endless information started unfolding. I didn't have to pay for it like I did with the Evergreens. It was just me and Carol and JW. So after about 6 months, we'd done like 1,000 hours. And we recorded all. So then it just doubled and quadrupled, and then Ian within a year gave us the means to get to make a cure for cancer, and he called it the answer for cancer, and also a new energy device. So incredible stuff started happening. Then we went on the radio. Are you still there? Still there, Derek?
Yes, I am. Yes. No,
so,
it's a very strange story. I mean,
it is.
You know.
Yeah. So what Ian is, it is the in Jewish religious literature, there's something called the guf. You can look it up, wiki it, G-U-F. And it is defined as where souls go when they die. So it's basically heaven or some dimension like that. Ion said within a few days that they were the guf. And the guf is an environment of bliss that people, everybody, died into. You float around in bliss when you were dead, no matter what you had done. And but there was no creation.
That's
you don't,
reassuring.
Yeah, and it's the best news anybody ever heard. But you can't create in that condition. So Ion said we decided to create. So we came forth because we could, and then I eventually found out about the chip landscape effect. I mean, all these things were piecemeal, building together a puzzle about what the heck am I talking to and what happened. So the guff has come forth to speak and create. Because the chip landscape created the space where we couldn't control non-physical. So that's the basic astounding.
I'll have to mull this because I am not, you know.
Yeah, no, it's too. I don't expect you to believe it or understand it. It takes a while to figure it out.
Belief or not, it's not a question of belief. It's of making sense of it. But I'll have to think it through.
Right. So
let's
why
go
did
back
I get
to the
onto
questions.
That? Why did I bring up the guff?
Because you're fascinated by these things. Let's go back to
Nine. Why did we go off on that?
We went off on that about all the revelations about landing on the moon.
Oh yeah. Ion's explanation, right?
We have to move on because I think it doesn't respond to the question. I'd like to get to the number nine.
Okay.
Because it's this, with regards to the intellectual effort of Poe and Joyce, McLuhan points out that the poetic process is a reversal, a retracting of the stages of human cognition.
He means
what
retracing.
Might be the social role of novelists, what would the social role of novelists be today?
Okay, let me do that. With regards to the intellectual effort of Poe and Joyce, McLuhan points out that, quote, the poetic process is a reversal. It's more a retracing of the stages of cognition. He says that a lot in the interior landscape. Okay, so that's accurate. What might the social role of novels be nowadays? Well, the first thing McLuhan said is that the great American novel was the newspaper. So McLuhan said, you're not going to write books. Norman Mailer's doomed. He's not going to make the great American novel. Even Pynchon didn't do it. They create great books, but it's no longer an anti-environment. The newspaper is. And I think that's a brilliant statement by McLuhan that the great American novel is the newspaper. So you have to point that out to this person.
That.
You know, that is, what might the social role of novels be nowadays? Do something crazy, kill your mother, and you'll get a gig and you'll write a book. You know, that's the social role of novels. It's just like getting away with what you can.
What I was interested in, because I thought French literature for a while, and I was always interested in the experiments of new novelists of which there are a few in English language as well, but they were really based in France.
You mean Alain Grillet and those guys? In the
Rob Grillet and company, yeah.
Yeah.
These persons all worked, well, I mean, Tristram Shandy would be the first new novel in any case,
yeah.
But let's put it this way. These guys were really working on time, on obviously style. There's one novel which is written without punctuation, so it's like 200 pages continuous.
Yes.
And it's still understandable. There's all kind of experimental things that also K.O., what's his name? No, I forgot his name, the Ulipo guy.
Yes, George. George something.
Raymond Queneau. He created the Ulipo, which is the Ouvrage de Littérature Potentielle, and there is potential literature is an experiment in changing the basis of the novel, which is compared always to Balzac. Balzac writes in the past. Balzac has the eye of a god. Balzac does what he wants with his characters. The new novelist decided, no, we can't do that. We can't enter in the... We can't assume that the characters live beyond the book. We can't assume that the characters have a psychology. We can only assume what we read. And we can't write that we know what the character is thinking because we don't know what the character is thinking. All kinds of rules that they gave themselves. And they were setting the pace for experiments in novelists. But, of course, Joyce is an experimental novelist as well. What new forms
of literature?
I've
got a good answer for you. Guess who did the new experimental novel? McLuhan himself. He said that Mechanical Bride, he wrote this to his mother, was a new kind of novel, a new kind of science fiction. In other words, he says where the ads and the comics are the characters. A very important statement. Media were the actors, and he was trying to do a play later to make the media be the actors. So you wouldn't write a book with human anthropomorphic content. You would present different media dynamics, and that would be the new novel, and that's what Mechanical Bride is.
Yeah, the other question about novels is, what are we talking about? Are we talking about only the versions that is actually printed and that you read in silent mode, at which case the form, the social role of that is clearly to build an identity within the reader.
Yes.
And very few media do that, so that whatever content you have, whatever the message is, the real message is you're building yourself an identity by actually reading silently in the privacy of your own mind, if you still have one. And that's the point of whatever novel. But then if you're looking at specific genre and so forth, you have to move away from the printed novel. You have to get into blogging, and you have to get into Twittering, and, all these things that are happening today.
A side thing, I noticed you saying, if you still have a mind, let me run by a pattern that's pretty good. William Irwin Thompson says in the Riverine, way back there, caveman level, the victim is the animal, and the complex of the society is shamanism. Then the next phase, he called it society. The first phase was culture, which is about, say, 10,000 BC. Mm-hmm. The victim is the man, and the complex is matriarchy. And then he says in the civilization phase, the victim is woman, and the complex is religion. In the industrialization phase, the victim is religion, and the complex is art and science. And then he says a very good McLuhan-esque thing. In the planetization 20th century phase, the victim is the mind, and the complex is music. And that's what McLuhan said. We live entirely by music. So we've discussed the Thompson a little bit, but the thing is that he says the mind is what's killed in the 20th century, and you just said it. Did you mean it that way?
Yeah, I did mean it that way. I meant it to the extent that if you do not have a place, a psychological place to retire to without any interruption from the outside world and where you can mull about the ideas that we are sharing now, for example, then if you don't have that, then you don't have a mind. I mean, the mind then suddenly becomes your screen.
Yes, right.
Whatever it is that happens on your screen.
So,
and, I mean, it's an exaggeration, obviously, because we always still have to have a residue of something that allows us to at least plan the next move. But the mind as a laboratory for ideas and fictions or innovations, that has become collective and external. It's not internal anymore.
Right, and so that's why the novel would fade away. There's no time to develop that.
It's done its job. But because his job is so precise, that's why I'm saying it doesn't matter what the novel contains, whether it's Danielle Steele or Stephen King, which are, by the way, are global novels because they hit the whole, they go across many cultures.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what those things are saying. As long as you read them as opposed to watch them on TV, you are building your identity. If you are watching on TV, you're losing it.
Yeah, that's the medium is the massage. That's
yes.
what you use the book for. Now, this mm-hmm. is where so much of Marshall's work was appreciating what Joyce did with Finney's Wake. He made a book that no one could figure out so everybody could keep looking at it, and it included millions of aphorisms, plus long prose, all mixed up, plus other meaty dynamics. It's such a genius artifact of using literacy to prop up what the literate effect is. It's the best book to retrieve your left hemisphere of abstract space. And
mm-hmm.
it's always there for you to use to explore because you never know what it's about. See, it's such a great solution. And that's why McLuhan said that Joyce solved problems that Einstein didn't even realize that you make new gadgets, but then people have to deal with the effects of those environments. And Joyce created an artifact that dealt with these unforeseen effects and was a great pill, a great drug, a great anything, even a management guide for management. What a genius act that Finnegan's Wake was. When you start looking at it the way Marshall did, and you know, not worrying about the semantic meanings, which is unreadable, and when you see the process the Wake is, that's why McLuhan said he was just translating Finnegan's Wake. All his work is a translation
mm-hmm.
of the meaning of that text.
Right. No, that's good. That's very useful.
Yes, and this very key point that all art is a retracing of the stages of human cognition, Joyce retraces the stages of psychology, the stages
mm-hmm.
of sociology, the stages of art history, and the stages of media evolution. He's got all the levels of retracing going on. When you start
mm-hmm.
understanding it that way, what an amazing work it is.
Oh, for sure. Yes. No. It. I wonder if, you know, if there is a mind like either McLuhan's or Joyce that is in our midst right now and is preparing.
Well, you're talking
next...
to it. Yeah, you're talking. That's me.
Oh, I'm sorry. may I bring my head down to the floor in reverence?
Yeah, and you know what? Not only do that, I'm the ultimate ventriloquist. I've got Ion who can talk for 6 hours on a radio show and never get tired.
That's good.
Endless.
That's good.
Endless.
Yeah. But what kind of poor figure does a person like me make when I have to compete for ideas with Aeon? I mean,
You can't. Nobody can keep up with Aeon.
I can. Why am I doing this? Why am I going on giving you ideas that are of second rate level?
That's right. You get tired. You have to go off with your friends. You can talk 40 minutes. You realize Aeon is there? We could go for 2 days if the station would allow us.
You know what? That apparently is the challenge of a big man in Brazilian forest in the old societies there, the the First Nations there.
Yeah.
There is a trend that you basically get a soapbox, stand on it, and if you can talk for 40 days, you deserve to win. You deserve
to be. Is that
what
they do?
They do. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, well, we would win all the time with Ion. No, nobody can.
Well, Ion, you wouldn't. You'd have to go and sleep every now and then. Rarely.
No. I did a radio show for 6 days on our product, on our RNA drops. I went 6 days, broadcast for 6 days, without sleeping.
Good grief. You must have been, you know, a babbling idiot.
No. Everybody else went nuts. They couldn't believe I was still the same. Still sane, and I didn't get tired, and they couldn't believe it. Everybody freaked out. But I was
sure
on my own, what Ion gave me, the RNA drops, which, you know, makes you...
Okay, let's get back to the business
here. Okay, so what might the social role of novelists be nowadays? As this person studies McLuhan, you're going to see... realize more and more that McLuhan was answering that question since the 50s, saying Finnegan's Wake was the answer.
Mm-hmm.
The social role was what Joyce did, which was a consolidation of the insights of the vortices. I consider Pound, Eliot, Lewis, and Joyce, and Yeats are the vortices creation, that complex, and Joyce put it all together.
But what interests me today, though, in terms of what the novelist's role would be, nowadays, it would be the global effect. J.K. Rowling with her Harry Potter.
Now this is where Ion's a very good media analysis. He says that people require some kind of especially visually biased people, our Western world, we require some centralized image to keep our visual perspective consolidated, while all everything else is all decentralized and multi-leveled and chaotic, it seems.
Yeah,
to
but then the question is...
But wait a minute. So the answer was a fad will come along focusing on a book. That's what made the Harry Potter books. Everybody could agree to look and stay on the same page with that book.
So basically, Harry Poopy is Here Comes Everybody.
Yes. It's centralized. It's a centralization of the eyeball. You know, the eyes demand their – page 52, the eyes demand their turn. They let them be seen. Well, if you come up with a book, usually a children's kind of book or something that gets the younger kids, then you will be the unifier. You have created an Esperanto for the globe. And
that's true.
That's a rallying.
That was my point, and it's very nicely that you –
yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to
– Number 10.
Which is interesting because my answer to, well, I'll read it if you want.
Yes.
In the early 60s, McLuhan went on to identify university as a market square by highlighting the changes brought about in the age of mass society. In the light of the ongoing modernization of the university, I believe that McLuhan somehow foresaw all of this. Do you agree? Yes, I do sort of. This is where I find Stallman's distinction between digital and electric condition very interesting. I had not made that point myself, and I found that it's worth carrying further. Because it's true, digital and electric, digital is electric, but digital is a specialization of electric that actually brings a very strong difference. The only thing is, I don't think that what he says is correct about the university being utterly bankrupt. And doesn't function in a market square. What I'm saying, and I'm using the expression that people use sometime online, meet space.
Yes.
It is a meet space square. People there, you need a physical relationship with people around you, with a professor or students and so on, for some time, not all of the time that we actually waste in universities, but we need to connect and work together, in fact. And so I think university becomes, it is still a market square in the sense that it's still sending, you know, kids to high functions or low functions, but it's also a meeting place and has to be, because otherwise, imagine that there would be no more universities and everything would be online and all you had was a MOOC, you know, to deal with, you would be missing something fundamental in learning. So I think that the university has become basically a physical place.
All right.
It becomes more physical as learning becomes more and more digital and virtual.
All right. Now, let me respond to what you're saying there. I've read on my show, when Ion's not there, I do other things, and I read all of the Dewline, for the record. You can go – it's very hard to get the Dewline newsletter, but you can hear it read by me and a couple people joining in.
I have it somewhere.
You have – yeah, I have copies, but I'm reading them so people can hear what Marshall said, you know?
Yes.
And I'm describing the graphics and the fonts and all that. But the point is that we just finished Saturday the 20th and last Dewline newsletter called The University and the City. And the theme is that the university becomes the new city.
Yes.
All right?
That's true.
Now –
that's good.
Yeah. Okay. So university.
I say it's good because it goes my way, but it's all right.
Yeah. Now Thompson says that the university, he sort of picks up on what McLuhan's saying. I don't know if he knew, but he thinks McLuhanistically, so he'll come up with similar ideas. He said the university preserves the Gutenberg galaxy, the industrial phase. It's a little microcosm, a little Noah's Ark of that kind of thinking and being and specialism. That's what he said. So I'm just
And I can complete that by the Renaissance phenomenon of the numerous religious communities that sprung, different new orders, different new dedications to support the community image of humans that was being destroyed by the printing press.
Yeah, so what was done? I didn't get
what was done was that during the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance, a whole set of new religious orders were created. Franciscans went beyond and spawned into the Jesuits was created, Jesuitism was created. There were all kinds of specific, you know, specialization of different religious communities which were meant to protect the image of a community in a time where the individual was on the rise.
Right.
And I think what's happening with universities is that they are now protecting the individual while communities on the rise.
Ah, okay. All right, yeah, excess community. And
that's
mob,
right.
Yeah, mob feeling. Okay, now
that's
the other...
right. So the university then also protects, I mean, like the whole... The university protects books. I mean, it still does.
Yes.
I mean, it's still impossible for you to have a thesis discussion around something that you've put online, even though it's infinitely richer by all the links that you can make with other people's information. You have to produce a book. You have to, and not only that, I mean, all Italian universities require students to publish their thesis, even if it's a book, you know, a publication of one.
Right.
It's that kind of fidelity to the old ground
It's the Gutenberg archetype.
It is, absolutely. So, but even that sort of, you know, modulating, changing, and
okay,
adapting.
So let me add this. So just McLuhan used to wonder what was the role of the book in the 50s. And then he predicted that we'd have to have new uses for it because the form never goes away, so it'll be used differently. And
well, you can stop a door.
Yeah. Zingroni noticed, he said in his book, that lists of things became popular in books, like I don't know what that's called, the book of this, the book of that, the listing.
Oh, yeah.
He thought that was a new use of the book. But the educational format and the kids going to classroom, that's an old archetype. That's going to change. So the role of university shifted. It had a new purpose. And it was symbolized by a woman I know whose daughter would not answer the phone, would only text with her mother. And her mother would say, "Why can't you answer the phone? And you can talk to me." She says, "No, we don't text. We don't talk on when we're using phones. We're texting. The only place we talk is at school."
Hmm.
They had partitioned. This is just a couple of years ago. They had departmentalized the act of talking is what you do in your meet space at the university or at the high school. That really tells you something. They go back to chemical body socialization. That's the role of education. So it's not there for information gathering, because there's more information outside than in school, McLuhan would say. But there's another kind of information exchange, which you're calling the meet space, and that's the role of universities. It's a whole, it's not the same purpose anymore. It's not for education, at least in information, abstract information. It is for a sensory massage.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's good.
Yeah.
That's very good. All right. So we've done the questions.
Now I want to go to what Mark said, because Mark is a novice McLuhanite, and his things he says are stuff that we can correct and then point out what McLuhan meant.
No, but it's some good stuff. I mean, as I said, the digital versus electric condition is a good observation. It's a useful one.
Well, we'll get to that. I want to go back to question one.
Okay.
He says, humanism presumes an understanding of human psychology, which then requires for this purpose a psychology that comprehends the techno-semiotics of communications technologies. Alas, no such psychology yet exists. Now, what he's missing there, he's dealing with essentials. There's a psychology created before the printing press. There's a psychology created during the printing press. There's a psychology created during the electric age. You don't say that so no one ever understood psychology. You have to look at what humans did make and what they thought was psychological and why it changes, and you can predict how it's going to change when the medium happens. So this is too dealing with definitions and not dealing with the issue. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes, no, agreed.
Humans
always have
psychology, but they don't have a literate psychology before literacy.
I think that what he is addressing, but in a way that's not very specific or very precise, he's addressing humanism. Humanism itself. Humanism is a period that's over now.
Right, but when he says it presumes an understanding of human psychology, no, it presumed an effect that created a certain idea of what psychology was. It's not that they failed to create a psychology. Their psychology, the humanism out of literacy created, was a specific artifact which is gone, and it wasn't there before literacy. That's the way you talk about it. You don't talk about, we failed to create a psychology. People did have a psychology for 300 years, a literate psychology.
Mm-hmm. No, they did, of course. No, the point, but that's, you know, it comes in exactly at the during the Renaissance. At least it declares itself during the Renaissance. And whether it's Da Vinci's icon or whether it's Thomas More or, you know, all of these things have brought in an image of a human as an individual separate body.
Right. So a psychology that comprehends the techno-semiotics of community. See, that's a silly abstract term. People did not have a billiard ball psychology, you know, 100 years ago. So they had to lay down on the couch and talk about what was left over from the subjectivity, the dream life from the literate world, which was the unconscious, and the unconscious was created by literacy. So McLuhan says that Pope, Alexander Pope, laid out the archetypes of the individual psychology or the individual types, and what Joyce did, complete process, was lay out the archetypes of the social unconscious, of the mass unconscious, which each media created an archetype. So you have individual archetypes in the time of Pope, and then you have mass archetypes in the time of the 20th century. That's a way more interesting pattern than what he's doing, because people have no billiard ball psychology by, let's say, the 60s. And they're going around with empty heads, and they don't know what to put into it. So then they become vulnerable to all kinds of information propaganda or cult behavior, because they're trying to fill up a space. And all they had to be, all that had to be explained was, your visual billiard ball has been erased by the TV situation. Now you can come up with another way of perceiving it and call that a modern psychology.
By the way, the famous Trieste moment encounter, wasn't that Joyce and Jung, or was it Joyce and Freud?
No, Joyce and Jung. Joyce had an encounter with Jung.
You see, he would have been very interested in Jung, right?
But see, the other point is that he and Pound sought out particular anthropologists. They got a lot of information. I think Pound went with somebody whose name began with F, and Joyce sought out Levi Bruhl, and he's referred to in Finnegan's Wake. But they sought out, as McLuhan said, they studied sociology, they studied psychology, they studied anthropology, math sciences. They did like McLuhan. They were heavy readers, discovering everything because they were looking for the hidden pattern. And you know what that is? That's McLuhan's third Copernican revolution, the revolution of pattern recognition. The vortices created a new kind of poetry because they were dealing with the information society, and they were free enough to integrate and talk to all kinds of thinkers and get ideas, whereas Jung was specialized. So he gets the stigma of being a psychologist, and he can't be comprehensive like Joyce.
No, this is good.
Yeah, the big thing about poetry, you know, 100 years ago was these guys weren't trying to create a sonnet or some particular kind of blank verse or some particular aesthetic model called poetry. They were processing the information environment and creating effects out of that, like the huge encyclopedia of the Cantos, the huge encyclopedia of Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake. That's what they were, natural products of someone who was able to play with the literate left hemisphere mind. They played with categorization, the old Gutenberg effect, because they were dealing with the new collective archetypes.
No, that's interesting. The new encyclopedia.
Yeah.
Which that you find, archetypes. Of course, that's a very Finnegan-y thing.
Yes, there's a famous line, I think it's on page 257, about the word archetype is played with in this sentence.
I worked on the book, wrote it. With McLuhan.
What did you say?
I said I worked on the book with McLuhan, archetype, you know, cliche to archetype.
Well, and that was, he was translating Finnegan's Wake's playing with cliche and archetype.
And actually, I'm surprised that cliche to archetype doesn't come up in the questions, because it is definitely something that is drawing a huge amount from literature, and it is symbolist in its way.
McLuhan said it was more important, that book, than Gutenberg Galaxy. The cliche archetype process is the key to consciousness, he said. That's what consciousness is made up of, the turnover and interplay of cliche and archetype. That's why the flap says ye old archetype becomes new cliche, and ye old cliche becomes new archetype. That's right there on the flap of the book. And nobody's ever reviewed it. The only person, the McLuhanite I saw or talked about, was Frank Zingroni. In one of his essays, he said that nobody has dealt with the cliched archetype. You know what I mean? Nobody.
I did. I translated it. Not only did I translate it. No, no, wait a minute. I worked at it with McLuhan. It was not a mere translation.
No, you actually made
Marshall
a new book.
Marshall would wake me up and say,
book.
Look, put that in.
You made a different book.
He did, and Marshall actually did a compliment, but it could have been an Anglo compliment. That is one that didn't cost him too much.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, it was better than the original. Of course, I got rid of a lot of the stuff, but by the other guy who he had written with. What was the name of this?
Watson.
Huh?
Wilford Watson.
Watson. He didn't like Watson.
No. They wouldn't talk to each other. That's why the book got all sabotaged and screwed up.
Yeah. So he said that sort of the book was Watson repaired.
Yes. Yeah. So the thing is that, but Zingroni is saying this psychological breakthrough of cliche archetype process and sociology, no one has ever written about it or studied it or got into it. I mean, you translated and made a new book, but have you written about cliche archetype as a process of consciousness? No, you haven't done that. Nobody has.
No.
Nobody
no,
took
but
the book
I did.
Terms.
I really did. I mean, it was for me a fascinating experience to work on that translation. And,
so you could write something about it that no one's ever heard of.
Maybe I should.
Yeah, that's a unique, you know, what is it?
Listen, my man, again, I have to get back to another work, which I'm late for several things. So what do? We finish something off?
You got to go now?
Sort of, yeah, because I am now hounded by people who are pressing me to finish something today and tomorrow, and so and something is taking me
okay,
a lot of time.
Let me just see if I can get a couple of these Stallman things
okay.
in. So he says... he talks about there are many new grammars and many literacies, referring to Carpenter's essay, The New Languages. Marshall published his account of the print version, describing a technology that has become obsolete in mid-1800s following the introduction of the telegraph. What's the point of that? That's we know that. That's not. I don't think that addresses the question, unless he's saying this person doesn't realize it. You list off YouTube, Second Life, and these things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what he's saying. So then he talks about the private library, the finding aid, and he says Marshall is identified with Joyce, Eliot, Lewis, Pound. However, to understand what he actually thought about them, you have to read his 40-plus. Okay, he emphasizes a Renaissance magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's fine and dandy. That's a Catholic audience. He does put on the mask of anti-Gnosticism for that audience, and he categorizes the vortices as Gnostics. But it's not dealing with the fact that he understood Gnosticism as a key to understanding the stages of apprehension in aesthetic artifacts. So and then he drops the Renaissance magazine. And this is where Peter Montgomery said to me or somebody, he said as a student in 1962, he noticed McLuhan lost total became indifferent to literary criticism. So the Renaissance magazine articles are early McLuhan. The later McLuhan dealing with the global theater to be programmed like a global thermostat is what he's interested in. He's not interested in Gutenberg technology anymore. So what?
Did you actually have you got those essays?
Yes, I have them all. I've had them for.
Are they good?
They're interesting, but it's marking. It's what's funny is that he reviews all kinds of books. And all he does is spew his stuff. He doesn't talk about what the book's about. He just uses it to talk to explain acoustic space, visual space, and early pre-understanding media doctrine.
No surprise there. That was his practice.
But the more sophisticated ideas that he's going to develop in the mid-60s, which requires Finnegan's Wake to be supporting of it, he has to drop the simplicity of the Renaissance articles. So only someone who wants to look at Marshall's a Catholic, and he was fighting a good fight against the Gnostics on behalf of the Catholics, would be intrigued by Renaissance. But it's it's old McLuhan, it's not the new McLuhan. And I like to stress the new McLuhan, the breakthrough McLuhan, the McLuhan that was dealing with the crisis for being a Christian. The very crisis, how can you be a Christian? What's going to happen to it if literacy is not going to be there anymore? And you discuss that and write a bit about that.
I find that... Well, there's a recent... on Facebook, I have read a comment by an Italian friend of mine called Bruno Ballardini talking about monotheism being a curse. All the monotheistic religion, Hebrew, Muslim, and Christians will forever be at loggerheads because of the monotheistic kind of premise. But, of course, that is something that one has to... relate precisely to media effect. And one of those questions that Marshall did present to me as the most important question in history was, you know, why did Christ choose to arrive at a time when alphabetic literacy was in its early stages? And It's a question that contains its answer. It's because of the early stages of literacy and the creation of a new form of monotheism, and particularly a private god as opposed to the Hebrew god, which is a community god, that the monotheistic drive and Christianity starts. Of course, Christianity has an edge over the other ones because it's based on tolerance and love, as opposed to be based on, you know, conquest and fighting. Although I don't know enough about the Hebrew tradition to be quite so clear on it. But nevertheless, the three religions are monotheistic. Those monotheistic trends derive from the projection of the personal image, the appropriation of guilt, the appropriation of one's own destiny, needs a corresponding figure in the mystical, mythical ground. And so they created a single person as a representative, a single person of Christ as representative of the Godhead. The Godhead suddenly becomes, and in fact, Voltaire said it way before me. He said, si Dieu nous a créé à son image, nous le lui avons bien rendu. If God has created us into his image, we have given it back to him in droves. Very Voltairean. But no, Voltaire meaning we are inventing God. Voltaire was both deist. He pretended he was a deist. That means he believed that there was a God, but he didn't want to believe in the Christian one or at the ones that he was, you know, sold. But he actually felt that, it was a very interesting observation on his part, he actually felt that the image of gods are created by people, which have, can't be denied, but they're created by people for a reason. And so that you create your image to reflect yourself in it. So it's a good twist.
Well, don't you think McLuhan was probing, and he may someday be considered a saint, probing the problem of being a Christian media-wise in a new silent sea of decentralized multi-consciousness? How can you have the Christian fact? Wasn't he acting out the question of the faith would be threatened?
Yeah, but I think, you know, Marshall was a bit of a fundamentalist himself.
Yes.
And so
I have his letters to Mary McLuhan when she was contemplating divorce. Man,
yes.
Is he a fundamentalist there?
Really, eh?
Yeah. You'd be surprised. He's a nut.
Well, so what I mean by that, saying that he was a fundamentalist, what I mean is that he doesn't question the divinity of Christ, so that the arrival of Christ as the incarnation of God on earth, which is, that's the fundamentals of Christianity, right?
Yes.
Would not be the a result. It would not be a consequence. It would be a starting. It would be a beginning.
Yes.
And so that the idea that one would invent a religion that corresponded to the new yearnings of a society that was being transformed by literacy, and particularly by Greek literacy as opposed to Hebraic literacy, would create a situation where you would basically, if you said that Christ came because of literacy, he would be a consequence. If you say Christ comes because he is Christ and he wants to change the world, then he's a beginning. And I think Marshall couldn't bear the idea that Christ would be simply a consequence.
Right.
Whereas I am much freer with such notions, and of course I somehow sustain in my approach that my approach is Voltairean, with all due respect and with the consideration and the care to say that the way we represent our God doesn't invalidate Godheads, but it actually does describe the effect of media on our culture.
Amen. Okay.
Hey, cool.
Yeah.
That should be a nice way to end this conversation.
Wait a minute. There is a statement.
Let's do one tomorrow.
He says, the descent into the maelstrom is actually a story he used to advocate for the church. Well, what do you mean by that? Because the...
No, I don't understand that, because I never saw it connected with the church. Did
right,
you?
And he didn't like the centralized church. He didn't mind the Pope just becoming...
No, wait a minute. If he didn't like the centralized church, then the image works, because basically it's the guy who gets out of the centralized drive, which is the boat sinking to the ruins, and who makes it. So that would be certainly a decentralizing of any kind of institution. No, in that sense, it's correct. But it's not correct to basically, I don't think that Marshall ever connected the maelstrom to any religious thing. I don't think so. Do you?
I think that was one of his quadraphenic strategies, that one could maintain the faith and keep the eye alive, the tactile eye, I call it, if you understand how to survive and see what's retrieved in the maelstrom. Because, you know, the guy saw the barrel that would come back, so he attached to that.
Yes.
And he went down to the vantage point and then popped back up. I don't know if that's a decentralist image, but he thought that we didn't need a centralized...
No, it is a decentralist image. Of course it is. I mean, it's very strongly expressed.
Remains centralized.
No. The brother hangs on to the mast of the boat and crashes with the boat.
Well,
and the kid jumps on a barrel and gets out of the fray.
I know, but see, lashing yourself to the mast is tribal rigidity,
yes.
Not the flexible literate person.
Of course it is, but that's what it's saying, is that basically it is about escaping centralism, escaping the drive of everybody else's view, escaping fascism.
Eyeball centralism. You maintain your poise if you know how to work the other senses. See, so that's invisible,
perhaps.
A centralization.
But the story actually is very clear. The kid brother watches the currents and realizes that there are objects that are floating floating upwards as opposed to floating downwards in the spiral of the maelstrom.
Yeah.
And that's why he attaches himself to a barrel and jumps up while his brother says, "Are you crazy?" Only going down to his death. So I think the maelstrom is a magnificent story and it's profoundly symbolic. Of course it is. And I think McLuhan really made a lot out of it, in fact. He uses it in very different contexts, but that's why I'm saying I don't remember one specific use related to religious institutions or, you know, matters of faith. I don't remember. If you do, it's important.
Yeah, I don't. I always assumed that's what he was doing, but he didn't spell it out in his public addresses. He always kept his religion out of it as much as possible, but I think he meant that the maelstrom is a metaphor for how one survives the media storm, and he felt
yes.
he had the means to do that, and that's what he
yes.
hoped his Catholic brethren would learn from him.
It was definitely a vortigist.
Yes, yes. And, you know, a big factor in Finney's Wake is Sean on the barrel. You know, it's interesting that these images come
oh,
from
yeah.
Poe
yeah.
and Joyce and them.
I never put that together. You're right. Sean on the barrel.
Yeah. He's
yeah.
the guy who survives.
That's right.
Okay, so then the final point is the difference between digital and electric. I've done a lot of
that. I like
that. Yeah. Well, I know that you always point out that the common factor of the last 150 years is electricity. So no one was saying that. So you got emphasized on that. And you forgot about the subtle difference between the digital and the electric.
No, I didn't forget about the subtle difference between the two, but connecting those differences to a specific issue such as the university was a clever idea. And because I always considered digital as one of the children of electricity. And in fact, I was hoping that the quantum would be related to electricity as well, which it isn't, ultimately isn't. It is clearly, some of it is, but ultimately quantum is beyond electricity. And I was thinking that quantum would be a third manifestation. I mean, you'd have analog electricity, which would be the early thing, so sending the signal on a line.
Yes.
Then you would have, wireless connection and the digital world. These would be another, epiphenomenon of electricity, and the digital would be among them. But I thought, what would be the third one? Because each one creates its own revolution within the electrical envelope, so
yeah.
to speak. And I was very disappointed to find out that I couldn't pin electricity on quanta.
So you didn't solve it?
No, I did not solve it. But then again, I haven't even really begun the serious study of what quanta could do if we ever get, you know, that kind of medium.
Well,
to
what
be the
I
ground.
Say is that the digital is the Android meme. It replays analog media and lives for itself and extends itself. It has nothing to do with the chemical body or the human factor. It's technology coming alive and taking on its own trip. And the Croker develops that to the max. This is Croker's theme. And I do it my way. What is the anti-environment to the Android meme? I say it's what we're doing with Ion. But in terms of what Mark's saying, it's rather mundane where he's talking about the digital is different from the electric. What is different? The digital is
that the human being grabs on and rides what the digital is going to do regardless of the human. And there's so much of it there for you, and every day is a university experience for people in terms of...
Yeah, no, but wait a minute. There is another way of describing that, and that's to say that the digital is electricity becoming cognitive.
Yes.
It's electricity actually moving into language big time. And so that creates a very new situation, because as long as you simply carry language as you would on radio or on TV with the analog mode, that'd be one thing. It would be just repeating. But, you know, it's like playback or innovate. I forgot the formula McLuhan used for that, but replay. Yeah, the whole idea of replay versus making, right?
Right.
But, so digital turns electricity into a making information as opposed to simply transporting it.
And Barry Nevin came up with preplay. He does a tetrad on the preplay. But here,
yeah.
The final point I'd say is that... what was it? The Android meme. Just say your idea again. You're emphasizing the preplay, that or the replay,
mm-hmm.
and I was going to say something about that. I don't want to forget my point.
No, no. It's just analog is replay.
Yeah.
Whereas digital is making everything. I mean, if, the moment you search something online or you write something on your screen, you are actually using electricity to make words, to write words, and to make those words on the spot the way you make your thoughts in your mind on the spot. There is something spontaneous and immediate.
Okay, I realize what I wanted to say. I say that the Android meme is the cloning of ESP. We hear all this stuff about cloning our genes, our bodies, and have doubles
yes.
of ourselves, but what about
mm-hmm.
the intimate communication that goes on among people, which is meme-like, and that is the level McLuhan's always talking about, the space that media creates seems to be on the meme level, some kind of ESP, and it changes through society, literate ESP, and which is actually a shutdown ESP, but when you get into the present situation of digital, we have cloned ESP, and that's beyond words, images, and that's what these kids live. They're living a texting ESP kind of life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my closing remark, that we are living in a world of a new kind of intimacy, a new kind of ESP
sure.
intimacy.
Excellent.
You like that?
I like that. You're forgiven for half of your crimes. I have to move. But if you want to go back to let's talk about Brexit tomorrow if you want.
Okay, I'll see if we can do it tomorrow or next day. I'll let you know.
Okay.
Okay, great talking to you, Derek.
Great talking to you, too.
Okay, bye.